What's up, everybody? It is 8 o'clock Monday night. You know what that means? It's another episode of the Pit Life Barbecue Podcast coming to you live from the Uncle Steve Shake Studios in Center Barnstead, New Hampshire. Thank you all for tuning in. I appreciate it. Let's see who's early. I know Dutch was in early, of course. Bat, what's up? Judge Wepp, what's happening? Yes, you, Dutch. All right. Everyone's trickling in. So, guys, we've got an incredible interview coming tonight. There's been a couple months in the works, and, he's been a very busy man, so we made it work. But just before we jump into the brass tacks, tonight's episode brought to you by, of course, Uncle Steve Shake. Uncle Steve Shake, what can I say? 16 amazing flavors, including the sauce with no name. Uses the freshest ingredients. Does everything. He's a one-man show, one-man company. From the mixing to the shaking, the sifting, the packaging, the bottling. You name it, he does it. In a day when customer service is at a minimum, he has customer service at a maximum. You send an email, you call him, he's the one answering the phone, talk you through any questions you have, flavor profiles, things like that. Check him out at UncleStevesShake.com. And on Facebook, follow his group, Uncle Steve Shake Nation. Uncle Steve Shake, shake some on everything. Also brought to you by Joe's Meat Market. Right in the heart of Royce City, Texas, is the absolute gem, Joe's Meat Market. Gabriel and his crew are unbelievable. Freshest cuts, specialty orders, freshest produce. He's your one-stop barbecue stop for whatever you're firing up the grill and the smoker on the weekend. He's got you covered. Like I said, he's got your meats, he's got your produce, rubs, sauces, seasonings, every other thing you need to do. That old school mom and pop shop vibe. Stop in, grab a bite to eat. He has a menu. Mom makes breakfast every day. So check them out, Joe's Meat Market, Royce City, Joe's Meat Market for the win. Tom, what's up? Wes Phillips, what's up, brother? Chris Rosinski, KC, what's up, brother? Quentin Nelson, what is going on, man? Been a while. So, ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, it is my honor to speak with this gentleman tonight. New York Times bestseller, journalist, barbecue Hall of Famer, founder of AmazingRibs.com, one of the best, if not the best, and longest running websites for the barbecue and grilling and live fire world. He's that famous, he only goes by one name, and you know it. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Meathead. Meathead, what's up, brother?
Hey, what a pleasure to be here.
Oh, thank you so much for taking the time. You've been a busy boy, obviously, the past few months with the deadlines and stuff for the new book.
Yeah, I mean, if anybody out there is thinking about writing a book, I have some advice for you. Don't do it. Oh my goodness. I've done several books. I used to be in the wine world before barbecue. Did a few books there, and now I'm doing it. And I'll tell you, it is just a lot of damn work. I turned in the manuscript about 2 weeks ago, and I'm still fussing with fine-tuning the photographs, cropping, balancing the colors and stuff. So I'll finally be out from under the gun in about a week or two and getting ready to take a vacation. And I've not taken a vacation in like 5 years. So I'm ready.
You're ready for it for sure. Well, funny you say the wine. You were a wine journalist for the New York Post and the Chicago Tribune?
The Washington Post and the Chicago Tribune. Yeah, I started a magazine many years ago called International Wine Review, and I was the wine critic for the Chicago Tribune, Washington Post, syndicated all the way down to Puerto Rico, Syracuse. And so I was wino, but somewhere around the year 2001, my love of barbecue overtook my love of wine, and I switched to solid food rather than liquid food. And I dove headfirst into barbecue, and it's been just a fun ride, a lot of fun. A couple of years ago, I got into the Hall of Fame, which was, the pinnacle of my career. And, I'm actually kind of slowing down. You know, look at anybody out there who's been an entrepreneur, who started their own business, knows what it's like. You work 7 days, you work 10 to 12 hours a day, you don't take vacations, you pay your employees before you pay yourself, and that's what I've been doing for like 40 years, and knock on wood, AmazingRibs.com is a small but profitable little business. I'm not about to buy any yachts or sports cars, but I am going to, I was so lucky to hire Clint Cantwell. He is the general manager, and he's taking over day-to-day operations, and he's doing a great job. And I'm actually going to take a vacation in April. Woo!
There you go. Any special place in mind? Or
we're going to Vegas. We're going to go see Jerry Seinfeld. He's I'm a big fan of the Seinfeld show and Jerry, so we're going to see Jerry, and then we're going to the Sphere, and just to 3 or 4 days. We're taking a bigger vacation in July. We're going to Alaska. We're going to Fairbanks and taking the Denali train through the Denali Park. Denali is the tallest mountain in the continental United States. And then down into the coast. And I'm just looking forward to, being a human again.
Oh, that'll be good.
I got advice. Anybody out there who's thinking about, I hate my boss, I'm going to start my own business and be free. That's a huge myth. And you want to talk, reach out to me, meathead@amazingribs.com. I'll take you down off the ledge. You're not free. You have employees that are your boss. You have bankers that are your boss. Stockholders that are your boss. You trade one boss for 100 bosses.
Absolutely. Mad Max, what's up, brother? Dave LeConte, what's happening? Matt Bukowski, what's going on? Uncle Steve is in the house. And Meathead, Uncle Steve seems to agree with you. Entrepreneur is just a nice word for dumb or glutton for punishment.
Yeah, Steve, you've got it. You know, I mean, there's this mythology. I seem to be overwhelmed by the concept of mythology because that's what I do with barbecue. But there's this mythology that America is built on the entrepreneur, on the individual. And there's a lot of that. I mean, certainly people like Steve Jobs have done fantastic things. But most of us, if you ever watch the Shark Tank, it always strikes me that they come out, they present themselves. They have 4 or 5 sharks sitting there. These are smart people, smart investors, wealthy people, and they reject them. They go backstage, and the camera zooms in on them, and they ask them, well, what's next? Oh, there are a bunch of idiots out there. I'm going to keep on going. They're going to lose their house. They're going to lose their wife. They're going to lose everything. I've been down that road. I had a wine magazine when I was a wino. Mm-hmm. And it didn't work. I mean, we became the number 2 best-selling wine publication, but being number 2 in the field wasn't enough. And I almost tanked everything. But fortunately, barbecue's been better for me.
Absolutely, absolutely. CJ, what's up, Big Rome? Oh, so me that obviously into the wine originally, but what made you make the jump from wine to barbecue?
Well, you know, the wine people will tell you that the idea of the wine snob is overblown and it's not true. It is true. There are, I got to say, I'm finding an awful lot of barbecue snobs who are just wine snobs in different clothing. On Twitter today, there was some guy showing a nasty Photoshop picture of a guy in a woman's bikini staring at a Traeger pellet grill. And this is what happens to you when you buy a pellet grill. And come on, guys. I mean, you know, there's this whole notion that unless you're burning charcoal or logs, you're not a real barbecue master. Well, fellas, I got to tell you, if you're not digging a trench in the ground, putting green logs across the top, burning dried wood in that trench until it becomes embers, and then throwing whole animals on top, you're not doing traditional barbecue either. If you have a steel device, whether it's a Weber Smoky Mountain or a big old offset smoker, these are modern innovations. And just get off of it. People who talk about cooking with gas grill, you might as well be cooking indoors. You're a goddamn snob. Come off of it. You know, what matters is how does the food taste? And I can cook really good food on my gas grills. I can cook really good food on my gas smokers. I got one of everything, by the way. I've cooked on everything under the sun. I know what I'm talking about. Just, you know, get off the snobbery. Barbecue is marvelous. It's fun and it's for everyone. And people who want to use pellets or gas, as long as the food is good, just back off.
Yeah, for sure. The jump into the barbecue, and like I said, you came out with your first book.
Ah, thank you. Look at that.
Look at that handsome guy on the cover. You know what I mean?
Oh, geez. You know, I was. There's a good story here. The book came out in 2016. And for a year, it was the number two best-selling cookbook on Amazon. The number one best-selling cookbook on Amazon was by Chrissy Teigen, the model.
Yeah.
And she's on the cover. I'm on the cover. She's unbuttoned down to here. And how do you compete with that?
Yeah, you really can't compete with that one. But it was funny because that's when I really got into – you know, the barbecue and grilling and live fire stuff myself was about 16, 17. And, you know, I guess I've always been taught if you want to, I got out of high school right on the edge of computers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could do a couple little things and play a couple little games. And they still had those things called floppy disks at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the still the go-to for anything you wanted to learn about and research, you had to go read. So
read.
I went to
read. You mean like a book?
Yeah. Pages, binder, the whole shebang.
What a concept.
Yep. And I go to my the bookstore and I'm in the section. Now this was before I knew any like names, you know, obviously from watching Pitmasters, you know, I knew Tuffy, Myron, Big Mo, Harry, Leanne, you know, everybody who was on the shows at that time. So I'm out there looking at the books going, okay, where the hell do I start? I'm going there. Then something just jumps in to me and I see that. I'm like, meathead. Okay. So I pull it off, start going through it. I'm like, all right, you know, the the how-tos, you got recipes, but it's from the beginning, from your coals to your wood and how everything functions. And, you know, I see the little clips of the myths, and I'm like, okay. So this meathead was the first barbecue cookbook I ever bought.
Wow, how cool is that?
And I lost it back in 20 or 21. He had a little incident up here at the house, and it got ruined. So thank you so much. You have made me whole again with this book.
Well, it's a good book, and if I can get in just a little bit of promotional, it's really a science book. The first half of the book is really science. Hopefully it's not too esoteric. Everybody can understand it. But there's a lot of mythology surrounding barbecue. Now, I got sucked into it today on Twitter. If you're on Twitter, go follow, because some guy posted a picture of meat, and he said, stop taking the fat cap off your meat. And that's wrong. The fat cap should come off, and I'll explain why. But I got into this debate back and forth, and it's amazing how many people are still clinging to the old myths about barbecue, which have been disrupted, shot down, destroyed. I call them old husband's tales by science. We live, this is 2024. We know more about the chemistry and the physics of what happens when you cook. Mm-hmm. And fat caps are made of oil. Fat is oil. Meat is 75% water. Oil and water don't mix. The fat within the muscles, the marbling, is crucial to mouthfeel and to flavor and to texture. But the fat cap, no way under any circumstances on this planet or any other can get into the meat because it's mm-hmm. water. That fat cap will melt off. And if you coat it with your rub and stuff, it's not getting onto the muscle, onto the meat. So when you serve it, especially like a brisket, which has a big, thick fat cap, the first thing your guests do is they cut the fat off, and there goes all your rub. So it doesn't, in fact, in any way enhance the flavor of the meat. Now, if you want to leave a little bit, I trim down to about a quarter inch on my briskets mm-hmm. or my pork rub, pork butts, because that will shrink under cooking down to about an eighth of an inch. Well, people will eat an eighth of an inch of fat attached to their meat, especially if it's got a lot of flavor attached. And mm-hmm. it will, you know, cooking the fat does alter its chemistry and make it taste better. But, you know, there was this huge back and forth. And one of a very famous chef jumped in to disagree with me, and I had to present him with the facts, and he backed off. You know, the fat on the surface is different from the fat in between the muscle fibers, vastly different, and you need to treat them differently. And then somebody else chimes in and says, well, it's crucial. It's a heat barrier when you're smoking. Well, that may be true on a Weber Smoky Mountain where the coals are underneath the meat, but most of us are smoking on things like pellet smokers or offset smokers, or even on a grill set up in two zones. So the heat is coming not from underneath, but from the side. So it's not acting as a heat barrier. So in any case, the bottom line is what do you want to eat, bark or fat?
Oh, bark all the time.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Hey, Mike, Big Cat 305, what's up, Al? What's happening, Gabriel? I think I saw my boy Big Kano in there. Josh, Skinner Farms, what's happening? Thank you all for tuning in tonight.
Are they arguing with me?
No, there hasn't been been one.
Okay.
You know, I know Big Rome was on your side with the pellet smokers.
The other big one that diverged into this debate online was marinades. And they're in the same situation. They cannot get beyond the surface. Now, they can get into the tiny pores, mm-hmm. and there's very narrow cracks and crevices between the fibers, and you can see them with a magnifying glass. But they can't go beyond that. They can't get deep. And, you know, the best example I can give you is your Thanksgiving turkey. How many of you guys out there go out and take your turkey and get it and dunk it into a beer cooler full of apple cider, garlic, black pepper, all those spices? And when you take it out, you can taste them on the surface. But if you slice that breast meat in the center, it tastes like turkey. You can't taste apple cider. You can't taste garlic. You can't taste any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. The only thing that penetrates is salt. Salt is the magic rock. Salt is just two atoms, sodium and chloride. And when they get wet on the surface of the meat, they get an electric charge. They ionize. And they can penetrate deep. But garlic, which is a huge molecule, sugar, 23 atoms, not two, 23. They just can't penetrate. They'll sit on the surface and they'll flavor the surface. So if you want to surface flavor your turkey, you don't have to submerge them in $10 worth of apple juice and half a bottle of garlic powder. Just sprinkle it on the meat, and away you go.
Yeah, that was when you said with the marinades, when that one of the points I was going to bring up to you literally was brining.
Yeah. Yeah. Brining works. Brining is important. And there's basically three ways to go about it. Salt, as I said, it's a magic rock. Salt does really wonderful things. When it penetrates, it alters the structure of the protein. It's called denaturing. And it changes the protein so that it can actually hold on to moisture better. The other thing is salt amplifies flavor without altering it. Garlic alters the flavor. Sugar alters the flavor. Makes it taste like garlic. but salt does not. And so if you want the benefits of salt, you can brine it by dunking it in a bucket full of salty water. And that salt will penetrate. It takes a lot of time, but it can go deep into the meat and penetrate. Or you can, that's called wet brining or submerging it in water. Dry brining is simply sprinkling salt on the surface and it gets wet on the surface and it can penetrate deep. And that gives you a little more control because if you make a liquid wet brine, how much salt is in that brine alters how much salt gets into the meat. But if you dry brine, and my recipe is a half a teaspoon of Morton's kosher salt per pound of meat, you can control the amount of salt getting in. So I'm a dry brine advocate. The other way is injecting. And you can inject with salt or other flavors if you want. I know people that inject Dr. Pepper into their turkey. I don't understand that. But if you want to inject, you can inject a saline solution or various other flavors. So salt's important. Salt, you want to get into the meat. And don't worry about it raising your blood pressure. We're talking about a very low quantity. Where you get into trouble is when you go to McDonald's and you buy those chicken nuggets. They're loaded with salt. A small amount of salt is going to enhance the flavor and enhance the moisture retention.
Beautiful, beautiful. And, you know, talking on injections, there was one year, and I learned real quick, and I actually heard you after the fact confirm what I found out. You know, with the different injections, I injected at one of my first turkeys, had the bright idea of going, let me just inject with melted butter. So I injected the turkey with melted butter, new different positions, and cooked the turkey. And when I started slicing it, I found spots, soft spots, if you will.
Pockets of butter.
Yeah. And it's like, why is that? And then I'm like, huh. Okay, something went wrong. Then I heard you say, if you're going to do it with butter, do it at once the turkey hits about right around 100 degrees. If I'm
butter melts more or less from 90 to 100 degrees in that range. So if you inject a cold bird out of the fridge, it's 38 degrees. You have melted butter, you inject, as soon as it hits that cold meat, it solidifies. So you get this pocket of butter. So what I recommend is, if you want to butterball your turkey or inject with butter, start cooking it and bring it up to about 90, 100 degrees internal, then inject the butter, and the butter will stay liquid, and it's not going to spread too far, but it will spread around a little bit, and you'll get that nice buttery character.
Absolutely. Oh, Brother Steven joining us from Trinidad and Tobago.
Wow, I'm coming there, Bubba.
Oh, yeah. Good guy right there, Meathead. Let's see. Look, what I loved about the book was like the myth busting. I love the scientific aspect of everything because I'm a geek when it comes to that stuff. Mm. I go all day long with that. But the myths, and like we had said, the barbecue world is, you know, full of them. You know, let's knock out a couple quick easy ones right off the bat. The blood in the meat packet.
Yeah. People often talk about when they cut up a steak and the pink juices come out. And they say, does anybody want blood? You know, and first of all, it's not blood. During the slaughtering process, almost all the blood is removed. There may be a few little spots of blood left behind, but if done properly, all the blood is gone. That pink juice is water that has been colored slightly by a compound, a protein called myoglobin. And the word for it is myo water. And myo water is thin, it's pink, and it's runny. But blood, if you think about it, think about your own blood. You know, it's thick. It doesn't run. It's almost black in color. It coagulates rapidly when it hits atmosphere. But these juices, when you cut into a steak, are thin, pink, and runny. It's not blood. It's water with a pink tint to it. And I like to say, every time you call it blood, somewhere in Indiana, a teenager becomes a vegan.
that's great. That's great. Yes. The myoglobin.
I'm convinced that I know several people who insist on cooking their steaks well done because they think that it's ridding the meat of the blood. Well, what happens to the blood if you're cooking it to well done? Where's it going?
Mm-hmm.
The myoglobin turns tan when it's cooked. And so as you heat the meat, it starts out pink. Well, actually, all right, if you start with a raw steak, it's almost purple in color. It's bright red rosy. And then it goes through a change of colors. As the myoglobin heats, it changes colors and eventually turns tan. But it doesn't, you know, you're not ridding the meat of blood. You're just converting the myoglobin to a tan color. And, it's not blood to begin with, so you're not ridding it of blood.
All right, good. That's one of them. So with the sticking with the juices, is cooking chicken till the juices are clear a good sign that the chicken is done? And you are past any type of sickness?
Most foods have bacteria on them. They're in the atmosphere. They're in the slaughterhouse. They're on the knives of the butchers. And there's bacteria. Some have more. Some have less. Chicken tends to be very susceptible to bacterial exposure because of the processes. It's dunked in water, and so it's recommended you cook chicken to 160 to 165 to kill the bacteria. And at those temperatures, you kill all bacteria in 7 seconds. So that's the recommendation. But the key here is the temperature. It's not the color. And in fact, it's been proven that often some chickens, the juices will not run clear until way beyond 160 to 170. And if you take it up that high, you're going to way overcook the chicken. We were talking about this earlier. The single most important advancement in culinary arts has been the appearance of inexpensive, high quality, rapid read digital thermometers. I mean, there are they range from $20, good one. You can get a good one for $20 that will give you an accurate reading in 5 seconds, all the way up to $150. And they're very precise and they're very accurate. And that's how you tell when chicken is done, not by the color of the juices. The color of the juices can depend on very many variables, not just the temperature. Among other things, it can depend on the stress the bird has been through prior to slaughter, believe it or not.
Okay.
It affects the protein. So digital thermometers, if you don't have a good one, go get one. We actually have working for AmazingRibs.com an electrical engineer. He used to be head of electrical engineering at ExxonMobil. He retired, and he was a fan. And we bought him a bunch of equipment where he can measure how precise the digital thermometer is and how long it takes to get there. And he tests thermometers for us. We have a searchable database. We don't sell any of them. You can link to websites where you can buy them. I think there's a $20 instant read thermometer that got his top rating. Everybody knows the Thermapop and the Thermapen by ThermaWorks. They're first rate, high quality gadgets. Fireboard makes brilliant thermometers. Yeah. There's a number of them out there. I've been having a lot of fun with a device called Combustion, which is wireless. It's got eight sensors in one probe. It's very expensive, like $150. Combustion Inc. It's a brilliant thermometer. I've been using that a lot. Get yourself some good thermometers. How embarrassing is it to serve expensive ribeyes to a table full of friends, your boss, and stand there and, make excuses? Well, it kind of got away from me. It's overcooked. The thermometer, you won't overcook. I mean, a medium rare is 130 to 135, period. Not 136, not 128, 130 to 135, or 125 to 130, rather. That's your medium rare. A good thermometer, and if you want a good temperature guide, this is one that we sell on Amazon with 90 temperatures on it. You get it free if you join our Pitmaster Club. Temperature. It's all about temperature.
Yeah. Because I always said, with the temperatures and ingredients, you can always add. You could always add more salt, more pepper, more garlic. You could always take that protein and put it back on the grill or flat top or in the oven to get a little more done. You can't start it well done and move backwards.
No. And you can't take the salt away either.
Yeah. So you can always add to it. You can't subtract. The other good one was, I guess it's probably one of the oldest ones, and I always love your reaction to it. We have to soak our wood.
I knew you were going to go with that. all the cookbooks. Wait a second. Let's see if I can do this. Can I turn my... Look at all the cookbooks I have. That's just barbecue books. There's another room the other side of that wall that has all kinds of other general cookbooks. I must have 200-300 barbecue cookbooks. My wife must have another 200-300 French, Italian, American cookbooks. And all the barbecue books on that shelf there tell you, soak the wood. Golly, folks, You know why they build boats out of wood? Because wood just doesn't absorb water.
Yep.
And we did this. I mean, it's really simple. You can do it yourself. Go get your wood chips or your wood chunks or whatever you're using and weigh them on a digital scale. Then soak them, not just for an hour, as most of the books say. Soak them overnight. Then you pull them out and pat all the surface water off and weigh them again. 5% weight gain. And all that weight is right on the surface where the meat, where the wood is fuzzy from the cuts. Mm-hmm. But if you take a saw and you cut that wood chip in half or that wood chunk in half, you won't find any wet spots inside.
Nope.
Water just doesn't penetrate the wood chunks. And when you take wet wood and throw it on your charcoal, what happens? Temperature goes down. Cooking is all about temperature control. That's all about, it's the most essential concept. When you throw wet wood on the charcoal, the temperature goes down, and all that smoke that you're seeing, okay, Daddy Dutch has got the answer. Everybody says, well, look at all the smoke it makes. No, it's not smoke. It's steam. If you hold up a mirror, you'll see. And that's because water evaporates at 212 degrees. Mm-hmm. Wood doesn't start to smoke till 500 degrees. So it can't smoke until all the water has burned off. So you throw wet chips on there, and right away they go up to 212, they evaporate, they stick a 212, that steam coming off, then it goes up to 500 and starts smoking. So just take your dry wood and throw it on the charcoal, and you'll get your smoke, or your gas grill or whatever else you're using. You'll get your smoke, plain and simple. You don't need to soak your wood.
Yep. You know, I love that. And the first time I heard your answer to it, I go, yeah, makes sense. Because obviously, like you said before we started, you know, yeah, that's Boston accent. We have a little ship that's been sitting in that harbor.
Yeah.
Since late 1700s.
In the harbor.
Still floating in there to this day. And it's made of wood. So I just always have loved that.
Well, with all due respect, it's probably got some sort of a coating on it. But still, you can take a raw wood plank and throw it in the water and it's not going to. Not going to saturate, not going to sink anytime soon.
Now, the smoke ring is, you can get a high, depending on what type of wood you use, of a darker or deeper smoke ring.
Not a heck of a lot. Smoke ring is really interesting. This is our friend Myoglobin again. Your meat is rosy color. Let's take a pork butt, okay? You take it out, and it's got a little pink color to it. That color is the myoglobin that is in the meat. There's myoglobin in all muscle. You have it. I have it. We have myoglobin. It serves a very vital function. It helps oxygen move from the blood into the meat. And so there's myoglobin in the meat. When you start to heat that meat, the myoglobin turns brown. But if you smoke that meat, the smoke contains compounds, most specifically nitric oxide, carbon dioxide, carbon oxide, other compounds, and they prevent the meat from turning brown. They make the meat remain pink. And that's what the smoke ring is. The smoke ring is the natural pink color of the meat fixed by the gases in the smoke. Take the gases away, just throw it in the oven, the whole chunk of meat will turn tan. But with nitric oxide, it will retain that pink ring on the outside. And it has no flavor. But what it does is it says, you know what you're doing. You're cooking with smoke.
Nice. Another one is the protein stop taking on smoke at a certain temperature.
Yeah. Yeah, that there's no barn doors on meat or protein. What happens is there's a process called thermophoresis. And you know it. When you step out of the shower and the mirror is foggy, that's because the tiny particles of steam are attracted to the cold surface of the mirror. And so they fog over the mirror. The same thing happens when you cook meat. The moisture in the air, and there's a lot of moisture in the air when you're cooking meat or when you're cooking with charcoal or gas. Gas, actually, one of the byproducts of cooking with gas is moisture. It sticks to the surface of the meat, just like to the mirror. The meat comes out of the refrigerator at 38 degrees. You're cooking it at, say, 225. So the smoke condenses on the surface of the meat, just like the steam on the mirror. And that's the thermophoresis process. The small particles stick to cold surfaces. So when you do that, you're going to get more smoke flavor while the meat is cold. And so a lot of people will tell you, take the meat out of the fridge and let it sit on the counter and come to room temp. Well, we've tested this, and you could do it yourself. A pork roast from the loin, which is maybe 2 to 3 inches thick, it takes hours to come to room temp because it's 75% water. It takes hours to come. And while it's coming to room temp, the bacteria are having a party. So you don't need to take the meat out and let it come to room temp. You, in fact, want it to be cold because when it's cold, it goes on the smoker. And because of thermophoresis, it attracts more smoke. So you get a more of a smoke flavor. So straight from the fridge to the smoker, more smoke flavor, less risk of bacteria, away you go.
Have you ever done any, experiments, researching on mopping the proteins versus spritzing the proteins?
Not mopping versus spritzing, but both of them moisturize the surface about the same. I mean, the difference is you're putting moisture on there, whether you're putting it on with a brush or putting it on with a spray. I don't know that would make a big difference, but it might be fun to try. The key here is that wetting the surface, not only does cold meat attract smoke, but wet surfaces make the smoke stick. Think about your car driving down the highway and you got bugs flying at the windshield. Many of them get swept right over the top of the car. A few of them, the bigger ones, smack into the glass and make a mess. Same thing happens when you're in the smoker. The smoke particles come up and some of them just go right over the top of the meat and out the chimney. But some of them hit the meat and stick. And if the meat is wet, they stick better. So spritzing helps the smoke particles stick to the surface, but it also cools the meat. And it cools the meat, and that evaporative cooling, that's water. It's going to evaporate. It's going to, same thing as when you're sweating out there cutting the lawn. You're sweating. It's going to cool the meat. That's going to make it take longer. The more you spritz, the longer it takes to cook. But that's not always bad, because we know that long, low, and slow cooks break down those tough connective tissues, the collagens, and the other things that make the meat tough. So spritzing is something that has pros and cons. It slows the cooking, which means dinner could be late, and your partner is in the kitchen and has all the asparagus and the potatoes ready, and the meat is not. It also attracts more smoke, which is good, and it can possibly make it more tender. But the more you spritz, the slower it goes. What people don't understand, a lot of people know that it's common to wrap the meat in foil or butcher paper. When you do that, you stop the evaporation. It can't escape. It's trapped inside the foil and the paper. So now it's not cooling. Now it's heating, and it's not hitting that coolness, when you don't have the foil or the paper, what happens is that the evaporation cools the meat. And at a certain point, depending on what temperature you're cooking at, if you're cooking at a low temp, 225 to say 275, you can hit a point where it cools as fast as it heats. The hot air is warming the meat, but the evaporation is cooling the meat at the same rate. And when that happens, you reach stasis, which is we call the stall. And anybody who's done a pork butt, and you know, I'll never forget the first pork butt I did. And dinner was like 3 hours late because it went up and it went up and up and up, and then it stalled, and it just stuck there. And it stuck there until enough moisture evaporated from the surface that the surface dried out. It became jerky. And that's what your bark is. Your bark is meat jerky. It's dried out meat that the evaporation has left. And so now the temperature can continue going up. So you wrap it in foil, you can stifle the evaporation, or you can leave it just sit out there and wait for the surface to dry. And when the surface dries, it will continue to go up in temperature.
All right. Well, we don't got to ask the next question. What is the science behind the meat stall?
Yeah. You've done this before. And this is something I work with a man. Early on in AmazingRibs.com, I tried to figure out a lot of this science, but I'm not a scientist. I'm just an inquisitive mind who has some knowledge of science. And a man who was fond of the website came there, and he started asking questions, and his name was Greg Blonder, and he was a PhD physicist, and he was head of research at Bell Labs. Bell Labs, anybody who knows anything about science knows Bell Labs is where the transistor was invented. Mm-hmm. And he was head of research there, and he's into barbecue. And Greg Blonder and I became friends, and we corresponded. And when I couldn't figure stuff out, I went to him, and he did research, and he did experiments, and he did a fun experiment to find out what caused the stall, because nobody really knew at this time. A lot of what we're talking about tonight may be new to your listeners, but I suspect a lot of them know this already, because we popularized it. It became generally accepted information. And now a lot of people write about it as if this was something they figured out themselves. I'm not trying to be vainglorious here, but I think we brought a lot of these ideas. We popularized a lot of these ideas. And what Greg did was he took a smoker and he took a big old globule of fat the size of a softball, a sponge saturated with water and a hunk of meat, put thermometers all of them and put them in. And because a lot of people thought the stall, which is when that temperature stops rising, it reaches stasis while it's waiting for the surface to dry out, and then the temperature can go up again. A lot of people thought that that was the collagen converting to juiciness, for the fat to render, all kinds of theories about this. But with the three pieces of meat that he did, or the three objects, put thermometers on all of them, it was clear that the one that stalled was the sponge. It was full of water. The fat globule didn't stall because there was no real water there, and the meat did stall. So he did several experiments, and it was, I can't take credit. I translated his research and popularized it and published it. And I'll never forget, I went to a couple of the popular barbecue message boards, and I won't drop any names, but I told them, I said, hey, we did it. We figured out what causes the stall. And holy Toledo, the crap that we got, that. I mean, you know how the internet is. I mean,
oh yeah,
we were just called every name under the sun. No, it's not evaporative cooling. It's rendering fat, or it's collagen changing phase. And you know, boy, I tell you, I got called names. But now we know it to be true.
All right, all right. We got one here I also love and enjoy, and I am so sick of it. It's right up there with whether beans belong in chili or not. Mm. Ooh, there goes the pen. Anyway, beer can chicken. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, all right. Beer can chicken. That's a big one. There's another one that I have gotten. Oh, my God. There are people who worship that little Buddha sitting on the beer can. But, all right, let's talk about it. Beer, chicken is done at around 160 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Beer is 90% water.
Mm-hmm.
At what temperature does water boil? 212.
212.
You take the chicken out of the fridge at 38 degrees and stick a beer can up its ass. Now you have a thermal mass that's around 38 degrees, even if the beer is room temp. You still have a chicken koozie. You've mm-hmm. wrapped your chicken, you wrap your beer in cold chicken. It's a chicken koozie. Now that beer will rise in temperature until it's the same temperature as the chicken, but it won't go beyond 160, 170, unless you badly overcook it, 190, 200. It'll never get to boiling temperature. And let's make believe for a minute it did get to boiling temperature. Where is that beer going to go? It's going to come out of the top and strike the very little bit of the interior of the cavity mm-hmm. that's above the beer can. And what's going to happen? It's going to condense and go back into the beer can, along with the fat. And then the fat's going to lay on top of the beer and prevent the beer from evaporating. And we've tested all this. We've seen it all. But the other thing is that chicken, 75% water, it's meat. Mm-hmm. There's no room in there for beer. It's fully saturated. You could take that chicken and dunk it in a keg of beer, pull it out and weigh it. It'll weigh just about the same as when you put it in because there's no room. It's fully saturated. So that beer can't penetrate the meat. And even if it could, it would only be that little bit on top of the can. There's no super highway leading from there down to the thighs and the legs and everywhere else. Now, I've documented this, including pictures and charts and graphs and everything. And I'll tell you, there are people who just don't believe it, who won't accept it. Who the facts just don't mean anything to them. And I'm not going to tread on the current world and political situation, but there are just a lot of people who just don't know about facts and don't care about facts.
Absolutely. That one for years now, it's, the beer can chicken. Okay.
Well, ask yourself this. Have you ever gone to a 4-star white tablecloth restaurant that serves beer can chicken?
No.
It's only a couple of barbecue joints. No trained chef cooks beer can chicken.
I've been to a lot of places that serve a beer can with your order of chicken.
Uh-huh.
It's a great combination.
It looks so cool, that little Buddha sitting on top of the can. But the other thing is they say, but my beer can chicken tastes wonderful. Of course it does. It's roast chicken. Roast chicken is wonderful by itself under any circumstances. Who doesn't love a good roast chicken? We had one tonight, as a matter of fact. Roast chicken's fantastic. You've just roasted the chicken sitting on top of a beer can. Beer has nothing to do with it. Now, if you want to make it really good, spatchcock that bird, which means cut it open, cut the backbone out and lay it flat so that the cavity where the beer can was can brown. Brown is something called the Maillard reaction. Mm-hmm. It's a chemical reaction with proteins and amino acids, and it makes flavor. Brown things have more flavor. The skin, the color of the meat turns brown, and you get more flavor, and it cooks faster, so there's less moisture loss. Or break it down into 8 pieces, 2 drumsticks and 2 thighs and 2 wings and 2 breasts. And now you can cook each to the optimum temperature, get brown on all sides, and cook it faster, cook it more moist. It's not as sexy and it's not as cute, but it tastes better.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Those were a few of them I missed. But there is one question I have never heard anybody ask you or you answer for that matter. Now, it could have been well before my time. Where did the name Meathead come from?
Well, I am a bit of a meathead, you know. And it's funny, talking about political thing. Rob Reiner was the meathead character on the Archie Bunker show. And perhaps a lot of your audience is too young to know the Archie Bunker show. But this was a television show that was a breakthrough back in the 60s, 70s. It featured a lovable, bigoted man and his touchingly sensitive and innately bright, but on the surface, not so bright wife. And then his daughter, his daughter and her husband are both flaming liberals. And she marries him and they're living in the house with them. And Rob Reiner played the son-in-law.
Yeah.
And Archie called him Meathead. And it was just, you know, it was a denigrating term. And the two of them were constantly at each other's throat. This show, if today, would be highly controversial.
No way.
Today, it would be just as courant as it was then. It was a marvelous show. And they raised all of the political questions about interracial marriage and bigotry and everything. And you still loved Archie, although he was a bigot. Mm-hmm. I watched it and enjoyed it. I was in college at the time, and my dad watched it, and he just started calling me Meathead because I was kind of on the liberal side. I was liberal. I was a hippie. And I came home once with shoulder-length hair and a mustache and a beard and rang the doorbell, and Dad looked through the peephole and said, "Who is it?" And so, you know, he called me Meathead, and it just kind of stuck. And then I've been fiddling around with computers for years. Back in the early 80s and 90s, when the internet started emerging, there were these chat groups and everything, and everybody had a nickname or an avatar, so I was just Meathead. It was a natural extension. It was my nickname. I was Meathead. And then later, of course, as I got into barbecue, it stuck, and I realized I have the marketing gene. If anybody out there knows me and my website, knows that I have the marketing gene. I've built a little website about ribs into a massive 2 million visitors a month, 15,000 paid members. And stick around, I'll give you a hint about something big about to happen. And with that marketing gene, I realized, you know, it's useful to have a brand. Branding is a whole, you know, they teach courses in branding. So Meathead became my brand. And I'm just Meathead, as you have shown here. I'm like Cher and Madonna, only have more facial hair. I go by one name. A lot of newspapers have trouble with that. They want to use my last name or the name I was born with, but I'm just Meathead. That's my brand. And you know what? When I call my accountant's office and she says, "Who's calling?" I say Meathead. She knows exactly who it is. You know, I don't have to. And what do you, I don't get the, "What are you calling about?" stuff. You know, they all know me. People, it sticks. People remember me. It's memorable. And it's worked for me as a brand. And it came out of the Archie Bunker show in the 60s and 70s.
All right. All right. Oh yeah. I even go back and, you know, YouTube or some of the old, the different streaming services now have a lot of the old shows on it. So I'll go back and watch those, and, you know, some of those shows.
They're very current and very entertaining. And yes. What's funny is because Rob Reiner played Meathead, he gets a lot of attacks. He's very liberal. and he's very anti-Trump. And he gets attacked constantly, viciously on social media. And when people attack him, they attack at Meathead, which, of course, is me.
Is you.
And you know, so I kind of have to say, hey, at Bonehead, you know. I'm Meathead. He's Rob Reiner, you know.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. But, you know, like you said, this one was, you know, the science of great barbecuing and grilling.
Show the name. Meathead. Yeah. That's the name of the book. There you go.
How is the new one, if I'm not mistaken, it's the Meathead Method?
Yes, that's the name of it, the Meathead Method. It's method-based. There's a lot of science in that book. This book talks about a lot of technique, a lot of fun stuff. Something I call sous vide Q, how you can start meat with sous vide, which is a technique that gets very, very tender, and then finish it on the grill, or the use of a fungus called koji to tenderize and change things. And we talk a lot about techniques. Some of them are out there, but you know, we get into you know, the concepts of two-zone cooking and how to set things up. And so it's more method and technique based than the last book.
Okay. And we're still looking at spring of 25.
Yeah. Finally. Anybody who's been following me knows that I've been working on this for quite some time, but I finally turned in the manuscript 2 weeks ago, and I'm just putting the finishing touches on the photographs. And so we are on schedule. Finally.
Beautiful.
Spring 25.
Beautiful. I would be amiss if I didn't bring up our mutual friend, Mr. Greg Rempe.
Oh, yes.
And can you say why grilled pineapple is the best thing
of all time? Son of a bitch, you. Yeah. You know, this is funny. If your listeners are not familiar, Greg Rempe has a podcast like this. He's been around longer than anybody. He's a real broadcast pro. It's on Tuesdays every week, and I show up once a month, and it's called Barbecue Central, and you should listen. He gets a steady parade of really good people. He's a good interviewer. And he asked me once what my favorite thing on the barbecue was, and I had to think for a second, but only a second. And the answer was pineapple. I love pineapple as it is, you know, raw. But when you grill it, the sugars caramelize.
Yeah.
And it just amplifies the flavor. And, of course, when I made the mistake in front of my good friend Greg Rempe saying that Meathead's favorite thing on the grill is pineapple, never caught the end of it. And then he hired a buddy who is a cartoonist.
Yes.
To do a cartoon of that conversation. And if you want to chuckle, go to YouTube and search for Meathead Pineapple, and you'll see this cartoon, and it's hysterical. And I'm guilty, and I'll stand by my – I love my ribs. I love my steaks. I love my eggplant parmesan, all of which I do on the grill, all of which recipes are on AmazingRibs.com or in my book, Meathead. By golly, I'll tell you, I do love my grilled pineapple.
Oh yeah. And I can't disagree with you. You know, it's
I'm a sugar addict.
It's the caramelization of it, and
I hinted at something which I can't divulge yet.
Okay.
But I can give a hint.
All right.
We are closing this week with any luck on the acquisition of a new website.
Ooh.
We are acquiring a really cool resource, which will be made available only to the members of our Pitmaster Club. Now we have a big website with 2,000 free pages with the thermometer reviews and the grill and smoker restaurant reviews. We accept no conflicts of interest. We don't accept junkets or samples, you know. So, we have a membership portion of the website, which has tremendous benefits. A bunch of free ebooks, a bunch of free magazines, a lot of cool stuff. Just go to amazingribs.com/pitmaster and check out the benefits. But there are some really cool new things about to happen. We should close on it this week. If we do, we'll announce it probably next week. And it'll become available within a couple of weeks. There's some work that needs to be done to make it available, but it's very cool. And it in itself is worth a lot of money. I'm paying a lot of money for it.
All right. And if I'm not mistaken, this Wednesday evening, you're having your monthly fireside chat.
Yeah. I do a fireside chat. Thank you for reminding me. Once a month, last Wednesday of the month, it's simulcast on YouTube, Facebook, and I have a guest this month. I don't always, but I have Bridget Binns. Bridget is a brilliant barbecue cook. She lives in Paso Robles. She has a bed and breakfast out there. She's done 30 cookbooks over the years with various professional chefs, and she's collaborated with me on my latest cookbook. And so she's working for us part-time, editing recipes and doing other things. And she's a really a very attractive and very smart and very talented lady.
All right. I can't wait. I will be there. But Meathead, thank you so much. I appreciate the time you've given me this evening. And I'm so glad that we were able to get it booked, and it was an honor to talk to you. Thank you again. But folks, I forgot to show them the best part, and they're all going to be jealous.
That's
right.
Yeah, you got the same copy.
Bobby.
Go ahead. You know, if you have a copy of the book and you would like, send an email to me, meathead@amazingribs.com, with your snail mail address. And I'll send you a signed book plate. A book plate's a nice little sticker that can go right inside that I will sign for you. And if you want it personalized, like to Joe, you're doing it all wrong, signed Meathead, I can sign it that way. And then you can give it to your brother, Joe.
Awesome. But yeah, like I had said in the emails back and forth, my opinion, this is the best barbecue book on the planet.
Well, thank you very kindly. It has sold 250,000 copies and still selling, and that's a lot for a cookbook. Most cookbooks do 10 to 20.
Yeah.
250 is, I think, only Stephen Reichlin's book, Barbecue Bible, has sold more. Yeah, and that's a landmark publication.
20th anniversary, something like that.
Of course, it's been out 15 years. Mine's only been out for 5 years.
But Meathead, thank you so much. Everybody go check out amazingribs.com. Meathead and amazingribs.com on all social media platforms. And sir, like I said, thank you so much. It's been an honor to talk to you this
evening. My fun. Go take the 30-day free trial in the Pitmaster Club. And we'll see you again. Let's do it again sometime.
Absolutely. Awesome, Meathead. Thank you so much, brother.
Take care. Well,
you too. Well, that's it, folks. Hope you enjoyed it. I had a blast speaking with Meathead. Like you said, I've learned so much over the years with, like, literally this was the first barbecue book I ever bought. And I'm still getting stuff out of it to this very day that I might have missed. So check that out. Not quite sure what's going on for next week, but I'm sure we'll have something popping. We always do. But thank you all for tuning in. I appreciate each and every one of you. And until next week, keep the smoke rolling.